Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have with me again Stephanie Moran. Today we're talking about what the animals taught me. I've interviewed Stephanie multiple times on her natural mental health series, all sorts of different topics there. Natural Medicine for First Aid Remedies. We interviewed her for Audacious Aging, which is a compilation work of many of the leaders of on aging. And then we've interviewed her for Goddess Shift, Women Leading for a Change, and Optimism, both books that Stephanie was the editor of. So welcome, Stephanie. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure, Susan.
So I had no idea that you had such a amazing sanctuary for animals until I read this book.
I'm getting that response from a lot of people. I live several lives.
Yeah. So you want to tell the listeners about, well, it starts with a love of animals, which I share with you, but how did you come to have such an adventure with our domesticated animals?
Well, I feel that these kind of things happen when you're led to your heart work. You're literally led to it. So I was living in the city as an adult. I grew up in the country, but as an adult, I was living in the city, one city or another, for 17 years, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. The sound of feet overhead and the apartment above me, and the people were just living their life. But I've reached my limit. I moved to the country and the animals started arriving. It was quite amazing. And I really didn't set out to do this. I moved to the country to write. I was working on a novel. And then 2 days after I arrived, a dying wild cat showed up and asked for my help. And so that started it, really. And then the animals began to get larger and larger. So
right.
I really feel that the animals came to show me what I'm supposed to do in life. And writing is one thing I'm supposed to do in life, which I knew from an early age, but this is the other thing. And it was really like everything coming together in this, which is my spiritual orientation, which is very earth-based, creation-based, and my writing, which, of course, I write about the animals to bring this issue of the need for respect for all beings and for all of nature, to bring that to the world, which many people are bringing that message, but we need more and more voices communicating that. And then my love of animals and my deep connection with them, which I believe I came into this world with. And, you know, all my years of living in the city, I never had an animal because I didn't want to confine them in an apartment. But I really feel like I've come home, which I did not grow up with farm animals. But the coming home is really to this deeper sense of connection, which is there within all of nature for us to tap into and remember who we are, really, because I believe that we come in with a natural connection to all of the world, to each other, to all of nature. So the first one to arrive after the cat the property where I moved after the cat arrived. There were horses and a wild desert donkey on that property, and the wild desert donkey was one of the ones that had been rounded up by the Bureau of Land Management to thin out the desert population. And he was absolutely terrified. He had never gotten over the trauma of how that whole roundup went. And so he was on the property, and I was working with him to try to establish trust. He did trust me. I was the only one that could feed him out of my hand, but it was limited until this little horse arrived. She was really the next one, and she's a miniature horse. Her top of her head comes out up to about my chest, and she and Gabriel, the donkey, formed this close bond. They became inseparable, and then it started from there, and I rescued Pegasus, is her name, the little white horse, because she was on a tether. I saw her on a tether. I could see it from where I was writing in my office. I couldn't bear it to see. It's terrible to keep a horse on a tether, to keep any being on a tether, really. So I went down and asked them if they would consider handing her over to me, and they really did want another home for her because they knew it wasn't a good way to keep her. So she joined us, and then after that, sheep arrived and donkeys, more donkeys, and it's just gone on from there. So it's been quite a journey, and I just feel so happy about it now. In the early days, I was quite nervous because I had never taken care of large animals. Well, I had been taking care of the horses on the property, but these were solely in my care, and I really didn't know what I was doing. They taught me fast. So that's the journey in a nutshell, and the journey continues. They're teaching me all the time.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really good to emphasize from the book is that animals, if they're ill, they actually know what they need. And they,
yeah, that's quite a wonderful health message, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I can give the story of Charlotte on that. Charlotte is no longer with us. She was quite elderly when she passed. She was the one probably who taught me the most because she kind of took me under her wool, to teach me what the way of the sheep is all about. She became quite ill later in life, and it's a fallout from the industry, which is I live in Sonoma County, and there's it's been a farming county and a livestock county for decades, and the vets were giving the farmers antibiotics to give their animals. It was widespread use of antibiotics, just kind of as prevention, really. And so what happened was there's now a strain of antibiotic-resistant staph, maybe more than one strain, I don't know. But anyway, she got an infection in her mammary glands, in her udder, that was antibiotic-resistant staph. And so we couldn't get rid of it. And I tried all kinds of natural ways, and some of them worked, some of them didn't. Her udder would go down in size, and it would swell back up again. Anyway, she was quite ill. And one night, I was just despairing because she wasn't eating any of the usual treats that I give her, and she was losing weight. So I was out there with her one night, and suddenly I had this image of her down in near the blackberry bushes. And so I said, blackberry leaves. So I went and just cut a mound of blackberry leaves, and that night she ate as many as I would give her. I just kept cutting and cutting and giving them to her, and she just ate every single one. And I went inside and looked it up online, you know, what are the properties of blackberry leaves, and it's drying and it's got a ton, it's a drying quality, so drying and shrinking is what we would go for with udder, right? And that's what she knew that's what she needed. Plus, it's really high in vitamin C, which would also help her combat an infection. So the wise one knew what she needed, and I was just thrilled. And I've had many, many examples like that where they know what they need.
Yeah.
And if we could only let them... Excuse me?
We've gotten away from that.
Yeah, we would all know that, wouldn't we, if we could be back in touch with that knowing.
Yeah,
so they've taught me, I mean, I already had a natural medicine background, so I was oriented to that, and I would use that with them, but they taught me just a whole lot that if we can let them go free. For example, there's chamomile growing around it grows up in gravel. It's kind of amazing. Comes up out of very bare ground. And that, of course, is great to handle horse colic. Give them a bunch of chamomile and run the horse to get the circulation going. So there's all kinds of natural remedies out there that they know about. And some that aren't in their natural environment. The other message I got was that Charlotte wanted watermelon, and it was in the middle of winter, but we were very lucky with the produce we get, so I was able to find a watermelon, and she ate that incredibly as well, just chomp, chomp, chomp. And the qualities of that are to help clear toxins. You know, it can help flush the kidneys. So she knew what she needed.
Yeah, a lot of people and animals quit eating when they're sick, and then will eat certain things, and that is an indication that they're medicinal rather than... I think it's a common thing to stop eating when you're sick. I mean, I think that's very common. And I think it may be that it takes energy to digest food. You're using that energy for other things, like getting over the infection.
Yeah, excuse me, I have to cough. I must be picking up something from you, Susan, huh?
No, I hope not.
I was fine before I got on the phone.
With the
not eating thing, it's kind of delicate with the elders because they can't really afford to lose any more weight. The sheep especially end up thin in the later years, and the challenge is to keep weight on them. I suppose that's true of many elder humans as well. But it's a fine line. They know what they need. If they have a healthy system, they can overcome their illness. But with an elder, I still feel I have to give a lot more help.
Right.
So they can make it through that. Anyway, the many, many messages I've got are not only health messages, a lot of guidance on that, but just this wonderful message of respect that I think people, I don't want to say all people, because I think consciousness is becoming greater and greater in this realm, but that people apply sensitivity and caring and respect to other animals, dogs, cats, the animals that many people live with, but farm animals they seem to be kind of the last bastion of respect. And I think, the small independent farms, they have a long history of respect, the way they treat their animals. But when we've moved into the world of agribusiness, all that was left behind. And now I think that there is a new teaching that has to happen here, is that these animals are as worthy of our respect as any other sentient being. And it applies to all levels of nature, in my view.
The book said that there were several countries, and I think California, that outlawed certain types of breeding with chickens that were confining.
Yes, I call it abomination, the way animals in agribusiness are kept and treated. And one of the abominations is battery cages. These are the cages that egg-laying hens are kept in the battery cage farms. So what you'll have is ranks of these cages, sometimes piled three on top of each other, and just rows of these, and the chickens never see natural light. They're under light, under fluorescent lights in there, or light bulbs, and they don't see natural light. They never put feet on the ground. They can't even stretch their wings in those cages because they're packed in. And there's a little conveyor belt. The cage is kind of slanted so that the eggs will just roll down onto this conveyor belt that's in back of the cages. And so they are just egg-laying machines, and that's the way they're treated. Like, they have no, they have no right to be a chicken, but they're not even treated like a living thing, really. So I was very honored to be part of a chicken rescue, which was a farm animal sanctuary that I'm connected with, not mine, another one. And I was waiting at the farm animal sanctuary when they arrived with the trucks with all the chickens they had rescued. And it was so wonderful to see these chickens for the first time able to put their feet on the ground, able to flap their wings, able to take a dust bath, these are all basic chicken activities, scratch in the dirt, fly, and be able to put their beak into a body of water instead of having to peck on a red dot to get some water, which is what they do in the battery cages. And they also cut their beaks in the battery cages so they don't peck each other. And many of these chickens arrived, they're just nutritionally just completely depleted because it's all going into the eggs. And their combs on the top of their heads were all faded pink and folding over because that's a sign of malnutrition. And it was wonderful to see their combs start to turn red and stand up again as they got the nutrition they needed. So yes, Amsterdam has outlawed battery cages. Sorry, I don't mean Amsterdam. I mean the whole, all of the Netherlands. And in the United States, California is phasing them out, and I believe they're going to be phased out all over the country. It's in the works, which would be quite wonderful.
Well, I think you point out in the book that there actually is karma that comes around to us for these activities, and one of them may be the methicillin-resistant staph that we're seeing in our hospitals, and you know, the other illnesses and things that are happening in our in the turkey and the chicken and the meats, the meat industry. There's a lot of contamination that, you know, you hear about salmonella and a lot of things. So those conditions do not breed healthy animals. Those animals do not result in healthy meat.
Well, and I think it goes beyond that, because I look on it. I look at it on an energetic level too, which is this meat. When an animal's in fear, so the way that they slaughter the animals, of course, there's no very little respect. If there's any respect,
right.
In the way that they're just correct. They're just sent up a chute, stunned, may not die right away. They know what's going on. So, mm-hmm. and the way they live is in a state of fear and high stress. So if you look at the physiology of that, you can say all that cortisol release, that's not a good thing for us to be eating in the meat. If people, I say us, I don't eat meat, but for those who do. And, you know, to be ingesting that, that's on the physiological level. But I also believe that the energy of fear and pain and suffering, how good can that be for people to be eating food that is that's the nature of the food? People talk about food that is prepared with love and what that and how much more nurturing that is for you. What about food that contains that kind of fear and pain?
That's true. Some people, when they get very, very sensitive, can even tell if the cook was mad when they cook the food.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So. So, what do you still have your cat?
I have a that no that cat was quite would have been quite how old would that cat be now? Probably in her his late 20s. So that cat passed on, and it was actually a rough life for that one, because I think he got dumped on the road where he arrived at my house. His name was Puka. He was quite an amazing sprite with lots of messages. Anyway, he went through many illnesses because I think his system was very compromised from that beginning that he had. And I managed to help him through every one until the last one, which was cancer. And I was able to prolong his life by 4 months, I think, with an herbal. It's nicknamed Purple Drops. People take it. It's Vita Elixir, and it's a very, very concentrated herbal remedy that has really helped a lot of people, and it enabled Puka to live for 4 more months. But no, he's not with me, but I have since there have been numerous cats who have come through the sanctuary to help. One in particular, Sparrow, this tabby cat, who, quite wise, she gave me a lot of messages about the other animals and what they needed. I feel very honored to have that kind of communication going on, which I think for some people regard this as way out there, but I look upon it as, I think this is a natural part of what we're capable of as humans. We've just cut out that side of ourselves. Those people call it psychic abilities.
With
telepathy.
Animals,
people have asked me, you know, do I call it telepathy? I don't really use a name for it, because to me it's really about relationship. When you're really tuned into relationships, you get information.
Right, right. Yeah, it's hard to know if it's coming from the animal. It seems like it's coming from the animal, though. I interviewed a vet one time that was highly, highly intuitive. And she could look at an animal and know it had a diaphragmatic hernia. I mean, that's pretty good.
She was
a
medical intuitive.
Doing the x-ray. Yeah,
she was a medical
with animals.
Intuitive.
And she was a vet.
That's another talent, yeah. Sometimes I get information like that, and I do believe my information comes from different sources. Sometimes it is from the animals, and sometimes it's from what people have called the universal archives, the Akashic records. That I think is just the the body of knowledge that is it's recorded somewhere so that we can access it. And again, it's really about tuning in, being quiet, opening to listening. And I you really have to pay attention, because the message can arrive in many different ways. Like, sometimes it comes in my dreams, sometimes it comes in that twilight state between waking and sleeping. Sometimes it comes directly when I'm out there looking at one of the animals. So it's really just about paying attention.
Yeah, I'll go over to somebody's house and they'll have a cat, and the cat will come up and it'll tell me. I mean, it'll say, I mean, I'll just know it has a bladder infection. Of course, I'm a medical intuitive with people too. And I'll say, did you know your cat might have a bladder infection? And they go, yep, we know. Because, of course, when cats have bladder infections, they pee a lot, just like you.
I forgot that you have that medical intuitive talent. That is such an excellent one to have. Yeah. A curse and a blessing, right?
Well, it's really good when you're a doctor, though. It's actually very helpful, especially a surgeon, you know, because we get all sorts of really good information in surgery that's helpful, like, you know, be careful about cutting there because, you know, there's a nerve there, and sure enough, there's a nerve there. It's not supposed to be a nerve there, but there is a nerve there. And my partner, Dr. Gordon, has the same ability, so that's good. We have a lot less complications because of it, I think, you know, because nerves aren't always where they're supposed to be.
It's really about listening to the guidance, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And we're real focused in surgery, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I mean, real focused, because you have to be.
I feel that we could use this ability in all walks of life and get the guidance we need to be able to accomplish whatever that field is really well.
Well, I've known some really remarkable fighter pilots and really remarkable surgeons and really remarkable scientists. Some are in my family, and all of them, when they're that good, they're intelligent, but what they really have is intuition. And many of them, like some of my family members, have, I mean, they know they hear from, you know, other dimensions. And that's real helpful because they can make breakthroughs, and they're pushing science ahead. I think I'm pushing surgery ahead. I mean, I do surgeries that nobody else does, and except Dr. Gordon, I taught him. and the fighter pilots are unbeatable. You know, they're really good at what they do. So it doesn't matter what you do. Einstein said the only really valuable thing is intuition. I guess he would know, huh?
Yes, I guess he would. Now, people use a lot of different names for that. I think you can call it whatever you want, but just listen, because that's such a source of information. I use it in my writing, too. I get guided on what I'm writing. And I've heard that from painters as well. I'm musician.
Yeah, I think one of the stories in The Goddess Shift was from J.K. Rowling, and she obviously got that. You want to tell the listening audience a little bit about what she said about the whole Harry Potter series? That was one of the best-selling books in history.
She was on a train, and she got the whole thing, boom, came down right into her head. She got the image of the boy with the lightning scar on his forehead, and then it began to unfold from there. Who is this kid, and why does he have this scar on his forehead? And quite amazing. She said she knew from the beginning where it was going. So it wasn't as if she wrote one book and then had to figure out the rest.
It was all mapped out.
It was
given as a package. Right.
It was all mapped out, which I just find incredible. Complex.
I know. Isn't that amazing? I have a feeling, too, she was a writer in a previous life that was pretty well-known, maybe, you know, Charles Dickens or somebody. I mean, she's really a good writer, and I think
interesting that she had to start out in this life with struggles, because she was on the dole when she was writing the first Harry Potter book.
You know, if you have a lot of money, you might not really sit down and write the books, huh?
maybe you know? That's so, yeah. Maybe that's so.
Or maybe she wouldn't, you know. I think you create what you need to get the job done.
And I'm just very thrilled for her success, because I think it speaks well of the world that the books became so very popular. I'm nothing but thrilled that those books have been so successful, because the messages in those books is so positive.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah.
It's the messages that we need about the struggles of good and evil, and being true to yourself and following your path. And yeah, it's really quite something.
There was a college professor I had on my TV show by the name of Barbara Gardner, who wrote a book called The Psi Prophecy. Have you ever heard of that?
Psi Prophecy, no. PSI?
No, Psi, S-A-I, from Sai Baba. Anyway, she had an interesting story. I've always found it fascinating. She was given the book, again, as a whole. And it's one of the most remarkable books, because it talks about the soul's purpose over multiple lifetimes from that vantage point. So, you know, most stories pretty much are in the here and now. But this one goes and talks about the tapestry that the soul weaves over many lifetimes, and the different lives and how they play a part in that tapestry. But anyway, she was a college professor, very left brain, you know, her heart wasn't particularly open. And she was given this in a dream. And she and her husband had a chance to go visit Sai Baba in India, and he called them out of the crowd, and he was talking to her husband, and they were talking to her translator. They were just talking, and she was over in the corner crying her eyes out because her heart was opening, and it was very interesting. She said, "I couldn't even talk because I was crying so much." She felt her heart open, and because it had not been open. And at the end of this, Sai Baba said to her, "That book you were given, write it, and I will bless it." Isn't that great?
That's wonderful.
So, I mean, it shows that books are given. And then J.K. Rowling is the other really remarkable example of that. But, you know, books don't come, we don't drag books out of us. They're actually in the higher level, and we bring them in. Great works of art are brought in. Probably paintings, music, and art are brought in. And I think it's, and even science is brought in. So when people are egotistical enough to think that it's their work, they should think again, you know. It's probably brought in through them, but I don't think it's theirs.
Yeah, and I feel that's very much the case with this book, What the Animals Taught Me, Stories of Love and Healing from a Farm Animal Sanctuary, because these are the stories that the animals wanted me to write. And the fact that Jane Goodall endorsed the book, I mean, this to me is just shows that this book was, this information, these stories, the message of the book, which is all about respect and unconditional love, all of that was meant to go out into the world, and I'm the conduit, because, I mean, how many books does Jane Goodall end up endorsing that are sent to her? Not very many. I just felt that was such a blessing and such, to me, a humbling experience of, this is the animals. This is all about what the animals are doing. And they asked Jane Goodall to do it, and she said yes.
Yeah,
I thought it was quite wonderful.
Well, it is.
I'm sure they contacted her in her dreams or something.
Right. Or maybe they had the book fall out from the pile it was in.
That
sort of thing happens, too.
Those tricksters. I don't know if... you and the listening audience can hear, but the sheep have been circling the house, baaing during our conversation.
Really?
Yes, they're wanting me to come out and shake the apples off the tree.
Oh my!
So you might hear that baa sound in the background.
Oh great! So who else do you have at the farm now?
Numerous donkeys. My beloved donkey Gabriel, who was, as I said, one of the founding messengers, and I call it the Animal Messenger Sanctuary because it's an acknowledgement of all the messages that animals and all of nature have to communicate to humans. And the basic message is you better wake up before it's too late and get back to a place of respect and honoring of the other parts of the world, other humans, nature, all beings, because you're destroying yourself. So that it didn't start out as a negative message. It's a very positive message of respect and unconditional love, but the result of doing this is extremely necessary for the human race. And one of the messages I've gotten is that unconditional love is the saving grace of the human race. Unless we can return to that on a very wide scale, so critical mass is reached, it's only going to continue to get worse, what we have to deal with on the planet right now. And the degradation of nature is one of the major things I see, and many people are activists about this. There's so many people working on trying to help the environment, save the environment. But The destruction is happening at such a rapid rate that we need all these people working on it, all of us. So anyway, who's here today? In most days, numerous donkeys, and Pegasus, the miniature horse, is still with me. I'm so thrilled. She's probably 27, somewhere around there. She could live to 35 mm-hmm. easily, maybe longer. And then numerous sheep. And I'm at shelter capacity now, so I cannot take any more animals. But sheep are a population that I want to continue to serve. I find them just remarkable beings. They're all remarkable beings, but there aren't many people working on rescuing sheep. Donkeys can mm-hmm. be kind of in the equine category, so they get a little more respect than beings like sheep or goats do. Just in general, you know, the more respect accorded to horses, the horse family. Although what I've learned about the treatment of, well, any animal, you just look at the picture of how they're treated by humans, and there's a whole range, a whole continuum. Some are adored and loved, and some are tortured and abused. So it's really, I see it as a continuum of healing we need to be on here. You know, let's move everything over to the side of more love and respect and honoring the sovereignty of each one of these individuals, which is really the message of the Animal Messenger Sanctuary, is that we have to recognize the sovereignty of each one of us. We have to acknowledge that in each other. And that's the sovereignty, to me, simply means we respect who this being is and don't try to make them who we want them to be. And that applies to human relationships as much as any other kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're coming into a time when the people who are very abusive will have a difficult time staying. So it probably will be, as they say, if we're going to get to 1,000 years of peace, a lot of people are going to have to not be here, you know, all the non-peaceful people. So,
or be transformed. Yeah. I'm, as you know, I'm an editor as well as a writer, and I'm working on a book right now where she's talking about inviting the forces of dark to transform into light and helping mm-hmm. them in that process, which I just found a revelation. I love that idea because, you know, it's what I've learned in the work that I'm doing is I cannot feel hateful toward people who are abusive because I'm just continuing that same cycle when I do that.
Right.
That was a big, big teaching for me because I used to get just incensed when I would hear about cruelty toward animals, for example, or children, mm-hmm. and human children. And I realized that that kind of reaction is just a perpetuation of the cycle of violence, that I need mm-hmm. to find a way to respect the soul of that individual because the soul doesn't want to be doing that.
True.
At least I don't believe it does.
Well, I think everybody will be given a choice, you know, to transmute or to, you know, go to another third dimensional world. But I think this, and I think it's more than just the Earth. I think it's probably the solar system and perhaps even the entire universe. It's transferring into another dimension.
Well, we have until December 21st to get our acts together, right?
Well, the timing's hard to know, but certainly the alignment occurs on that date. That's astronomy. That's not up for a debate. So, but there was an interesting YouTube video I watched called The Secret of Secrets, Carbon 666, that showed the picture of the dimensional shifts. They talk about the Big Bang being a point that goes into a line and then curves around on itself, and then you get a plane, and then that curves around on itself, and then you get the 3D world we're in, you know, three dimensions of, we're actually in 4D because we have three dimensions of space and one of time, and they said that's curving around on itself, and he doesn't say when, he says he doesn't know when, but the next stage will be four dimensions of space and one of time. But it just gives you some graphic ideas on how to think about this dimensional shift we're in and its effect on, you know, the elements we're made of, which he says we're made of carbon-12, and he predicts that in the next dimension will be mostly carbon-7. And I've heard similar things from other sources that say the actual building blocks of what we're made of are shifting. So if you've been feeling these spinning sensations and all these strange sensations in your body since July, that's probably the shift occurring in you. But it's also occurring in everything, which is interesting.
Yes, I can't say that I date the shifts from July, but I've been feeling shifting going on for maybe a year and a half.
Right.
So I guess
yeah.
The timing doesn't really matter. It's
well, I'm sure it's been going on that long. You know, it's a process.
Right. And Many people have been experiencing this. I have a friend who was just telling me about all the people that she knows in her life that are undergoing dramatic shifts of all different kinds, a lot of it physical. And she was just saying how many people have a serious physical illness. It just seems to have stepped up. And I'm going to knock on wood right now because it's not happening among the animals on the sanctuary, and I really don't want it to.
Right. Right.
I don't think they need to go through that learning. They don't need to have that learning.
No. Probably not the ones that were attracted there. I mean, there are animals that probably are challenged, though, because when the energy goes through our chakra system, if the chakras are blocked, if the energy systems are blocked, then that's probably when you get illness.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because the other work I do is, I don't know if you know this, Susan, because I'm not sure we talked about it before, but I'm doing energy healing for animals, and I got trained in this really wonderful technique called healing touch for animals, and the name is a bit of a misnomer because it's energy work. It doesn't really need to involve touch, but that's always a nice added feature in doing energy work is to do hands-on, but it doesn't need to be that way. I do distance work as well. But what I've discovered with that is that almost every animal that is a rescue animal, there's one or more chakras that are compromised. So they're not open. Yeah. They're not flowing. Right. They're not flowing fully. And the work I do helps restore that. I work with animals of all species, and it's really amazing how fast most of them, once I do the correction, once I clear, balance, and strengthen the energy field and clear those chakras, it's pretty amazing how quickly that can happen with animals. It takes a little longer with humans, but animals, because I think their energy fields are so much more balanced than ours anyway, and sometimes I've worked with, like, a dog, for example, who had a pretty rough beginning, and I find that his energy field was in pretty good shape, which kind of amazed me. I just had to make some few minor adjustments. They're very good at keeping themselves aligned. They need some help. The rescue animals need some help. Animals who have, it really comes down to animals who have had bad treatment from humans. They're the ones that need the most energy work. And I'm heartened by this work because I see the results of having turned that around. An animal that's like a cat or a dog who is just kind of out of their head with the trauma they're carrying around with them, they kind of melt into relaxation. It's so beautiful to see.
Yeah, the similar things occur, say, on battlefields. You know, the trauma, the post-traumatic stress disorder, they called it shell shock in the World War II arena. But essentially, if anybody is is exposed to violence, even if they're, you know, part of, you know, the armed forces and signed up for that, it does have an effect on them. It really does. It's very interesting.
And that energy medicine is being used with a lot of veterans with great success. There's there was a pilot study at I'm trying to remember. Is it Edwards Air? Is that an Air Force base? I'm not exactly sure.
California.
It was a VA hospital back east, and they did a study with veterans who had PTSD, and they used emotional freedom techniques, the EFT, the tapping technique, and amazing results with that. And there are more studies underway. There have been more since then, and it's there's even a website called BattleTap. People can sit there and do the tapping, just looking at the video on this site. Uh-huh. They can tap along, and I just think this is a wonderful service, because that can take place anywhere. Then people can do that wherever they are, and it's so important given the load that veterans have to carry. And I think there's much more respect for them now than there was during the Vietnam War, after the Vietnam War, for example, where some were even ashamed to say that they had been in Vietnam. I think there's more recognition of PTSD, but also of what veterans have to go through, what soldiers have to go through, and more of a commitment to try to help.
Yeah, I didn't realize it, but you've heard the term going postal?
Yes.
That's because so many veterans were given jobs in the Postal Service after Vietnam, but their post-traumatic stress wasn't treated.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, I always wondered why the Post Office.
Yeah, I did too until I realized that.
Yeah.
But, they get paranoid, you know, something sets off paranoia, and I'm sure every day we have things that could set off paranoia if we had that tendency. And then they're trained in weapons, and they probably have weapons, you know, because they're soldiers. They were soldiers. And then you have the shootings.
Because
they're paranoid.
That.
You know, they're back on the battlefield.
Well,
except it's your local post office.
Yeah, I just really hope that the men and women who are coming back from Afghanistan in particular, I just hope they're getting access to the help they need, because that's just not something that a human being should have to handle on their own.
Yeah, I think unfortunately a lot of them are being treated with SSRI inhibitors like Prozac and Xanax.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which will cover it up maybe, but not really treat it. I think the energetic methods actually release the energy, which is what you need to do.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing also about, I know this from a friend of mine who works from a center for survivors of torture, that talk therapy does not help, because the whole thing with PTSD is they are reliving it. They don't need to relive it anymore.
Right.
So that's what's so
in their
wonderful
brain.
About some of the... What's that?
No, that's very true. It's actually in their brain. I mean, it's a cyclical thing in their brain.
Right, and so the energy work, one of the things I think is wonderful about it is they don't have to relive the trauma to clear it from their energy field. There's various techniques that you do not have to go back there and relive it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is important.
I find all that very, very hopeful.
Well, I mean, there's really not that much difference between the post-traumatic stress that a soldier would get if he was blown up in his Humvee and, you know, his fellow soldiers were dying around him and he had his leg blown off, and that of a dog that was, you know, kicked every time it did something it shouldn't, or kicked just randomly, or beaten randomly. See, there's no difference, really. It's
a state of terror.
It's a state of not
terror.
Knowing when something bad's going to happen.
I go back all the time. This comes to my mind in all these kinds of conversations, where there was a study about different kinds of reinforcement. This was with rats, at lab rats, and they discovered that the variable reinforcement was totally crazy making for the rat. that when, you know, the pellet would come out at a certain time when they pressed on the bar, that they could put up with. They could put up with the wait in between of how long it would be.
Right.
What they couldn't put up with was clicking on the bar and nothing would happen. Clicking on the bar, sometimes something would happen.
Right.
Sometimes the pellet would drop down. So it was completely crazy. And I think of that a lot because this is what we're talking about. When something, when there is no consistency in, say, an animal's life where they never know when they're going to get hit with something awful, that makes them, I mean, you could just use the old phrase for that, a nervous wreck. I mean, that's really what PTSD is, a nervous wreck, the old language for it, where you just can't live under that kind of variable. It's kind of negative reinforcement. But I'm hopeful with the energy medicines that once people are out of those situations, they can get some help, as can the animals.
Yeah, there was an interesting study done on rats where they were just randomly shocked with electric shocks, and they all developed heart disease. And then they studied the
subject. This is a subject that I just find it absolutely appalling what is going on in scientific labs, what scientists are willing to do to animals. That's a whole other area. But I just wanted to say something about I'm going to be treating dogs that belong to homeless vets. I'm going to be doing the energy medicine work at something called a stand down for Homeless Veterans Day.
Uh-huh.
They're having it in my area. I'm thrilled that these things are going on. These are to give services of all different kinds to homeless vets. So it would be medical, it would be dental, it would be food, it would be clothes, it would be help with finding housing, jobs, and anything the person needs. And last time they held one of these, many of the veterans brought their dogs, who are beloved companions. And the dogs, of course, need care, too. So I'm going to be going down in September to treat the dogs. I'm just thrilled.
Oh, great.
And there are Healing Touch people. These are Healing Touch for Humans. There are practitioners that are going to be offering their services to the veterans as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Some very hopeful things going on.
Yeah, I think energy medicine is and energy healing techniques are going to be a lot quicker at releasing energy and straightening out energy fields and having things a lot cheaper. Number one, we need medical care that's cheaper. And number two, medical care that lasts, that we're not dependent on taking a pill for the rest of our life that has side effects eventually. So I'm very hopeful.
You know, I'm using this technique for pre- and post-surgery. So
yeah,
it
works
very,
great
very
there.
Helpful. What's that?
We do it all the time.
Yeah, so what do you do for pre- and post, Susan?
Healing. I'm not a Reiki master or anything. I just do healing. I just do.
Uh-huh.
I hear what to do and I do it. It's just a guidance thing.
Is it like a laying on of hands? Is that what you're?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Or sometimes. Yeah. Or balancing the electromagnetic body sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes telling the person something they need to know.
Uh-huh.
It's important. You know, just whatever comes out in the session.
I'm so inspired that the way you conduct medicine, it's fabulous. I really am.
Well, I'm inspired that you were inspired to be an editor so I could get published.
Yeah.
That was fun, too.
And that was very fun. I love those books. For the listeners, we're talking about Goddess Shift, Audacious Aging, and Optimism, the three anthologies that Susan... You're in all three, right, Susan?
No, just the two. You offered me Audacious Aging, but I said that
you decided
I wasn't
you didn't
interested
want
in aging, but I didn't know you got it.
That's right.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, those
well,
are great books.
I wanted to give my website for people
so
that they can learn more about me. It's www.stephaniemarone.com, and it's stephaniemarohn.com, and I have a blog as well, which you can connect to through the website, and there is information about the sanctuary and the books on there, and the pictures of the animals.
Yeah, and Stephanie has really good books on natural medicine treatment of psychiatric diseases, probably the best series I've ever seen. and including bipolar, autism, schizophrenia, depression. What are some of the other ones?
Addiction, anxiety.
Addiction.
I just wanted to mention that Susan, did I? We talked about the new edition of the bipolar book, right? The bipolar disorder.
Because
I think you and I. Do you have that? It's the new edition. I'll send it to you if you don't. Anyway, for the listeners, it's the Natural Medicine Guide to Bipolar Disorder. I just had a new edition come out this past year. And then there will be a new edition of the Natural Medicine Guide to Autism coming out in February of this next year.
Great.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
How long ago did you write this book?
It's been 10 years. And the books have continued to do well. Because the information is really... the only thing I had to update in it was the statistics. And unfortunately, in terms of autism, the statistics are much more dismal now. Oh, it's just amazing. Yeah. When I wrote that book 10 years ago, the CDC was, you might say, reluctant to say anything more than 1 in 500. And now they are freely saying 1 in 150. So this is
incredible.
Startling. There were some places in the country back 10 years ago where it was 150, 1 in 150, and it was documented.
Mm-hmm.
But the position of the CDC was that was unusual, and there was something weird about those areas perhaps. Of course, that's not the CDC language, something weird about those areas. But one of them, for example, had a landfill, you know, so they were thinking of something to do with a landfill.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's sadly much more prevalent. But I added hopeful new information in that book about one of the major issues, which again is very controversial, the whole issue of vaccines. Do they or do they not contribute to autism? I think it really has to be considered that the rise of autism paralleled the rise of increase in the number of vaccinations that a child receives in the first years of life. Plus, they do the terrible combination vaccines. So it's like this huge onslaught on the immune system. So anyway, there's a whole protocol now for using homeopathic nosodes to clear the adverse effects of those vaccines. So from the body. And I wrote about this technique in my first edition of the book, but it was there weren't very many people doing it, so it was really hard for parents of children with autism to find somebody that could do this for them. Now, thanks to this wonderful Dutch doctor, Dr. Tinus Smits, he has since passed on since I wrote about him the first time around, but in the intervening years between when I wrote about it and when he died, which was just recently, he set up a whole protocol and certification for people to know how to do this. So there's many people trained around the world now in his method, which is just fabulous news for parents of children with autism, that there are many of them that say very clearly these symptoms did not start until right after the child had their 15-month shots. So, we don't need to say causality, we don't need to go there, we can just go ahead and clear, because it can't hurt.
And also,
the proof, is in the reduction of symptoms. What's that?
It is. Cod liver oil has saved children who develop the high fevers and, get real ill after the encephalitis symptoms after a vaccination. Or a series of vaccines.
How much cod liver oil do you give? That's really good to know.
It's just whatever dose you would give the kid for that, their weight. I guess it depends, because you can have a 6-week-old or you can have a 5-year-old. They both can get the symptoms of encephalitis. And Stephanie talks about that in her book really well, about, kind of how the inflammation in the brain and the closing of the fontanelle early can be part of the pre-autism picture. You want to stabilize the membranes with with cod liver oil. Or probably other oils are able to be done, but kids are given cod liver oil all the time, so parents don't feel, you know, that giving a child cod liver oil is anything, you know, out of the ordinary. Kid may not like it that much, but, you know, it's certainly a certainly a well-known treatment.
Yes, so it is. I didn't know.
A rescue thing you can do right away.
Well, that's wonderful to know. I hope people are listening that need that.
Yeah, right. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a wonderful conversation, as usual.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, we've been interviewing Stephanie on her latest book, What the Animals Taught Me, Stories of Love and Healing from a Farm Animal Sanctuary. And next week, we'll be interviewing Anthony Lauder on 24 Paths of Wisdom. And then the week after that, James Wasserman on the Temple of Solomon. I'll have to figure out how that relates to health, but I'm sure it does somehow. Anyway, thanks so much. Join us next week for Temple of Health's radio show.